That was a passage from Nicholas Sparks' novel, The Notebook. I hope you enjoyed listening to this short reading. Thank you for listening to The Big Snore. Until next time. Noah got up at 5 and kayaked for an hour up Bryce's Creek as he usually did. When he finished, he changed into his work clothes, warmed some biscuits from the day before, grabbed a couple of apples, and washed his breakfast down with 2 cups of coffee. He worked on the fencing again, repairing most of the posts that needed it. It was Indian summer, the temperature over 80 degrees, and by lunchtime he was hot and tired and glad for the break. He ate at the creek because the mullets were jumping. He liked to watch them jump 3 or 4 times and glide through the air before vanishing into the brackish water. For some reason, he had always been pleased by the fact that their instinct hadn't changed for thousands, maybe tens of thousands of years. Sometimes he wondered if man's instincts had changed in that time, and always concluded that they hadn't, at least in the basic, most primal ways. As far as he could tell, man had always been aggressive, always striving to dominate, trying to control the world and everything in it. The war proved that. He quit working a little after 3 and walked to a small shed that sat near his dock. He went in, found his fishing pole, a couple of lures, and some live crickets he kept on hand, then walked out to the dock, baited his hook, and cast his line. Fishing always made him reflect on his life, and he did it now. After his mother died, he could remember spending his days in a dozen different homes, and for one reason or another, he stuttered badly as a child and was teased for it. He began to speak less and less, and by the age of 5, he wouldn't speak at all. When he started classes, his teachers thought he was retarded and recommended that he be pulled out of school. Instead, his father took matters into his own hands. He kept him in school and afterward made him come back to the lumberyard where he worked to haul and stack wood. "It's good that we spend some time together," he would say as they worked side by side, "just like my daddy and I did." During their time together, his father would talk about birds and animals or tell stories and legends common to North Carolina. Within a few months, Noah was speaking again, though not well, and his father decided to teach him to read with books of poetry. "Learn to read this aloud and you'll be able to say anything you want to." His father had been right again, and by the following year, Noah had lost his stutter. But he continued to go to the lumberyard every day simply because his father was there, and in the evenings he would read the works of Whitman and Tennyson aloud as his father rocked beside him. He had been reading poetry ever since. When he got a little older, he spent most of his weekends and vacations alone. He explored the Croatan Forest in his first canoe, following Bryce's Creek for 20 miles until he could go no further, then hiked the remaining miles to the coast. Camping and exploring became his passion, and he spent hours in the forest, sitting beneath blackjack oak trees, whistling quietly and playing his guitar for beavers and geese and wild blue herons. Poets knew that isolation in nature, far from people and things man-made, was good for the soul, and he'd always identified with poets. Although he was quiet, years of heavy lifting at the lumberyard helped him excel in sports, and his athletic success led to popularity. He enjoyed the football games and track meets, and though most of his teammates spent their free time together as well, he rarely joined them. An occasional person found him arrogant. Most simply figured he had grown up a bit faster than everyone else. He had a few girlfriends in school, but none had ever made an impression on him, except for one, and she came after graduation. Allie, his Allie. He remembered talking to Finn about Allie after they'd left the festival that first night, and Finn had laughed. Then he'd made 2 predictions. First, that they would fall in love, and second, that it wouldn't work out. There was a slight tug at his line, and Noah hoped for a largemouth bass. But the tugging eventually stopped, and after reeling his line in and checking the bait, he cast again. Finn ended up being right on both counts. Most of the summer, she had to make excuses to her parents whenever they wanted to see each other. It wasn't that they didn't like him, it was that he was from a different class, too poor, and they would never approve if their daughter became serious with someone like him. "I don't care what my parents think, I love you and always will," she would say. "We'll find a way to be together." But in the end, they couldn't. By early September, the tobacco had been harvested, and she had no choice but to return with her family to Winston-Salem. "Only the summer is over, Allie, not us," he'd said the morning she left. "We'll never be over." But they were. For a reason he didn't fully understand, the letters he wrote went unanswered. Eventually, he decided to leave New Bern to help get her off his mind, but also because the depression made earning a living in New Bern almost impossible. He went first to Norfolk and worked at a shipyard for 6 months before he was laid off, then moved to New Jersey because he'd heard the economy wasn't so bad there. He eventually found a job in a scrapyard, separating scrap metal from everything else. The owner, a Jewish man named Morris Goldman, was intent on collecting as much scrap metal as he could, convinced that a war was going to start in Europe and that America would be dragged in again. Noah, though, didn't care about the reason. He was just happy to have a job. His years in the lumberyard had toughened him to this type of labor, and he worked hard. Not only did it help him keep his mind off Allie during the day, but it was something he felt he had to do. His daddy had always said, "Give a day's work for a day's pay. Anything less is stealing." That attitude pleased his boss. "It's a shame you aren't Jewish," Goldman would say. "You're such a fine boy in so many other ways." It was the best compliment Goldman could give. He continued to think about Allie, especially at night. He wrote her once a month, but never received a reply. Eventually, he wrote a final letter and forced himself to accept the fact that the summer they'd spent with one another was the only thing they'd ever share. Still, though, she stayed with him. 3 years after the last letter, he went to Winston-Salem in the hopes of finding her. He went to her house, discovered that she'd moved, and after talking to some neighbors, finally called RJR. The girl who answered the phone was new and didn't recognize the name, but she poked around the personnel files for him. She found out that Allie's father had left the company and that no forwarding address had been listed. That trip was the first and last time he ever looked for her. For the next 8 years, he worked for Goldman. At first, he was one of 12 employees, but as the years dragged on, the company grew, and he was promoted. By 1940, he had mastered the business and was running the entire operation, brokering the deals and managing a staff of 30. The yard had become the largest scrap metal dealer on the East Coast. During that time, he dated a few different women. He became serious with one, a waitress from the local diner with deep blue eyes and silky black hair. Although they dated for 2 years and had many good times together, he never came to feel the same way about her as he did about Allie. But neither did he forget her. She was a few years older than he was, and it was she who taught him the ways to please a woman. The places to touch and kiss, where to linger, the things to whisper. They would sometimes spend an entire day in bed, holding each other, and making the kind of love that fully satisfied both of them. She'd known that they wouldn't be together forever. Toward the end of their relationship, she told him once, "I wish I could give you what you're looking for, but I don't know what it is. There's a part of you that you keep closed off from everyone, including me. It's as if I'm not the one you're really with. Your mind is on someone else." He tried to deny it, but she didn't believe him. "I'm a woman. I know these things. When you look at me sometimes, I know you're seeing someone else. It's like you keep waiting for her to pop out of thin air to take you away from all this." A month later, she visited him at work and told him she'd met someone else. He understood. They parted as friends, and the following year he received a postcard from her saying she was married. He hadn't heard from her since. While he was in New Jersey, he would visit his father once a year around Christmas. They'd spend some time fishing and talking, and once in a while they'd take a trip to the coast to go camping on the Outer Banks near Ocracoke. In December 1941, when he was 26, the war began, just as Goldman had predicted. Noah walked into his office the following month and informed Goldman of his intent to enlist, then returned to New Bern to say goodbye to his father. 5 weeks later, he found himself in boot camp. While there, he received a letter from Goldman thanking him for his work, together with a copy of a certificate entitling him to a small percentage of the scrapyard if it ever sold. "I couldn't have done it without you," the letter said. "You're the finest young man who ever worked for me." He spent his next 3 years with Patton's Third Army, tramping through deserts in North Africa and forests in Europe, with 30 pounds on his back, his infantry unit never far from action. He watched his friends die around him, watched as some of them were buried thousands of miles from home. Once, while hiding in a foxhole near Rhine, he imagined he saw Allie watching over him. He remembered the war ending in Europe, then a few months later in Japan. Just before he was discharged, he received a letter from a lawyer in New Jersey representing Morris Goldman. Upon meeting the lawyer, he found out that Goldman had died a year earlier and his estate liquidated. The business had been sold, and Noah was given a check for almost $70,000. For some reason, he was oddly unexcited about it. The following week, he returned to New Bern and bought the house. He remembered bringing his father around later, showing him what he was going to do, pointing out the changes he intended to make. His father seemed weak as he walked around, coughing and wheezing. Noah was concerned, but his father told him not to worry, assuring him that he had the flu. Less than 1 month later, his father died of pneumonia and was buried next to his wife in the local cemetery. Noah tried to stop by regularly to leave some flowers. Occasionally, he left a note, and every night, without fail, he took a moment to remember him and then said a prayer for the man who taught him everything that mattered. After reeling in the line, he put the gear away and went back to the house. His neighbor, Martha Shaw, was there to thank him, bringing 3 loaves of homemade bread and some biscuits in appreciation for what he'd done. Her husband had been killed in the war, leaving her with 3 children and a tired shack of a house to raise them in. Winter was coming, and he'd spent a few days at her place last week repairing her roof, replacing broken windows, and sealing the others and fixing her wood stove. Hopefully, it would be enough to get them through. Once she'd left, he got in his battered Dodge truck and went to see Gus. He always stopped there when he was going to the store because Gus's family didn't have a car. One of the daughters hopped up and rode with him, and they did their shopping at Capers General Store. When he got home, he didn't unpack the groceries right away. Instead, he showered, found a Budweiser and a book by Dylan Thomas, and went to sit on the porch. She still had trouble believing it, even as she held the proof in her hands. It had been in the newspaper at her parents' house 3 Sundays ago. She had gone to the kitchen to get a cup of coffee, and when she'd returned to the table, her father had smiled and pointed at a small picture. "Remember this?" He handed her the paper, and after an uninterested first glance, something in the picture caught her eye, and she took a closer look. "It can't be," she whispered, and when her father looked at her curiously, she ignored him, sat down, and read the article without speaking. She vaguely remembered her mother coming to the table and sitting opposite her, and when she finally put aside the paper, her mother was staring at her with the same expression her father had just moments before. "Are you okay?" her mother asked over her coffee cup. "You look a little pale." She didn't answer right away. She couldn't. And it was then that she'd noticed her hands were shaking. That had been when it started. "And here it will end, one way or the other," she whispered again. She refolded the scrap of paper and put it back, remembering that she had left her parents' home later that day with the paper so she could cut out the article. She read it again before she went to bed that night, trying to fathom the coincidence, and read it again the next morning, as if to make sure the whole thing wasn't a dream. And now, after 3 weeks of long walks alone, after 3 weeks of distraction, it was the reason she'd come. When asked, she said her erratic behavior was due to stress. It was the perfect excuse. Everyone understood, including Lon, and that's why he hadn't argued when she'd wanted to get away for a couple of days. The wedding plans were stressful to everyone involved. Almost 500 people were invited, including the governor, 1 senator, and the ambassador to Peru. It was too much, in her opinion, but their engagement was news and had dominated the social pages since they had announced their plans 6 months ago. Occasionally, she felt like running away with Lon to get married without the fuss. But she knew he wouldn't agree. Like the aspiring politician he was, he loved being the center of attention. She took a deep breath and stood again. "It's now or never," she whispered, then picked up her things and went to the door. She paused only slightly before opening it and going downstairs. The manager smiled as she walked by, and she could feel his eyes on her as she left and went to her car. She slipped behind the wheel, looked at herself one last time, then started the engine and turned right onto Front Street. She wasn't surprised that she still knew her way around town so well. Even though she hadn't been here in years, it wasn't large and she navigated the streets easily. After crossing the Trent River on an old-fashioned drawbridge, she turned onto a gravel road and began the final leg of her journey. It was beautiful here in the Lowcountry, as it always had been. Unlike the Piedmont area where she grew up, the land was flat, but it had the same silty, fertile soil that was ideal for cotton and tobacco. Those two crops and timber kept the towns alive in this part of the state, and as she drove along the road outside town, she saw the beauty that had first attracted people to this region. To her, it hadn't changed at all. Broken sunlight passed through water oaks and hickory trees 100 feet tall, illuminating the colors of fall. On her left, a river the color of iron veered toward the road and then turned away before giving up its life to a different, larger river another mile ahead. The gravel road itself wound its way between antebellum farms, and she knew that for some of the farmers, life hadn't changed since before their grandparents were born. The constancy of the place brought back a flood of memories, and she felt her insides tighten as one by one she recognized landmarks she'd long since forgotten. The sun hung just above the trees on her left, and as she rounded a curve, she passed an old church, abandoned for years but still standing. She had explored it that summer, looking for souvenirs from the war between the states, and as her car passed by, the memories of that day became stronger, as if they'd just happened yesterday. Hello and welcome to The Big Snore. In each episode, I will read a passage from a book, an article, a magazine that runs about 15 to 20 minutes. You can choose to listen to this as a bedtime story or just a story at any time of the day. Today, the passage I'm reading is from a book I'm sure everyone has heard of. It's called The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks. And yes, it's quite unlike me to pick a Sparks title, but I really like the movie, and I'm quite obsessed with the fact that it's two Canadian actors that play the lead in this film. I'm Canadian, and I quite like it, so I hope you enjoy.